From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a big hack, curbs on the USA, more hats in the 2016 ring, a killing in Boston, and more allegations of homegrown terror. With the USA Freedom Act, Congress reined in the Patriot Act and domestic surveillance. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy.
We passed the most significant surveillance reform in decades. We've done it by setting aside ideology, setting aside fear-mongering.
Four new candidates in a crowded 2016 field, Rick Perry, Lincoln Chafee, Lindsey Graham, Martin O'Malley.
I am running for the presidency of the United States of America.
I'm formally entering the race for the Democratic nomination for president.
I'm Lindsey Graham, and I'm running for president.
I am a candidate for president of the United States, and I am running for you.
And as many as 4 million current and former federal employees' personal information compromised. Here's NBC News' Andrea Mitchell.
Officials say this could be the biggest cyber attack in American history. The culprit, they say, China.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Lisa Lehrer of the Associated Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on the NSA, the big hack, homegrown terror allegations, Bo Biden, Caitlyn Jenner? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Wilmington, Delaware, where she's covering the Bo Biden funeral, is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
From Washington, Lisa Lehrer joins us, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Lots of action on the 2016 front this week. Lisa, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Lisa.
Can we dive right in on this alleged Chinese hack? 4 million federal employees, and I guess lots and lots and lots of access to all of the records that are in there. I'm kind of speechless here, Nancy. You don't know what to say about these after a while. They just keep coming. They seem so big. They seem so deep. The government says, is telling reporters China, and China says no. And then what, Nancy?
Well, you know, that's the big problem, is China says it's being slandered. And as one federal official pointed out, China is a big place. These attacks could be coming from the government. They could be coming from criminal groups. We just don't know. And you talk about the big, all these big hacks. This is the biggest of the federal government. They basically got information about all 2 million federal employees, plus about another 2 million retirees. We're talking about names, personnel information, in some cases social security numbers. And the thinking right now is that, you know, this could have been for fraud purposes, to use that information to try to get money. It could have been used to try to learn more about the U.S. personnel system so that Chinese spies can blend in more easily when they come to the U.S. There are a lot of options right now.
You know, Lisa, with when it comes to big hacks and crime, we tend to think Russia or Eastern Europe. China seems more like we have the sense of it as more state-oriented. Mm-hmm. But either way, Lisa, at some point, when you get hacks this big with so much sensitive information out there, how do we ever get to something like accountability? How many things can you just write off and say, well, okay, you know, we'll give you a free credit check?
Right. That's a really big question here. And this is something the administration, the White House, has been discussing with China for quite some time. I remember I went on a trip with President Obama to Sunnylands out in California. It must have been, gosh, already 3 years ago at the beginning of his second term. And this was a major topic on the agenda with the new Chinese prime minister. It's not clear how you move forward with this, especially because you don't know, is it government, is it an outside entity? And what's concerning about this attack, I think, is not even so much the size, is that it sort of signals a new chapter in online attacks, that the sense of experts, at least at this point, and granted it's still early, is this was not about sort of phishing, trying to information to, you know, get your credit card online or get people's social security number to make money, you know, as a business online, but about espionage, so that Chinese hackers were using this to get personal information about government employees for some later purpose. And the U.S. government and security experts aren't exactly sure what that purpose is right now. So that's really a scary thing.
Jack Media, you know, one doesn't want to make too much of this, but neither too little. We remember, of course, the Maginot Line, where the French put up all these fortifications against the Germans, and the Germans just drove around them. Look at our giant military, all that hardware out there. In an era where we are so dependent on all these digital connections, you know, maybe all that hardware could end up being beside the point in a conflict. How do you know when you're even in one, when you just shut down without a shot being fired?
Indeed. You know, we need something like the equivalent of mutually assured destruction here, deterrence, which we had with nuclear weapons. But there isn't one here.
Yeah, well, we want to know about all the Chinese employees' personal information.
No, there's no deterrence. So with deterrence, you don't have to worry about what the other nation does. There's a built-in check. There's nothing like that here. It's the Wild West. Or east, and it seems we're helpless before it. And as you say, our Maginot Line defenses just don't seem to be working.
Though there's talk that the U.S. has to be tougher here. It came up with the South China Sea Islands, and in general in this relationship and others, that the U.S. can't just roll with these perpetually. An irony this week that while that is happening, China's like, or whoever it is, sort of just flipping through millions of Americans' personnel records. The NSA being cut off from its easy access to American phone records. This was a very, very hot issue in the Senate. In particular, Mitch McConnell, majority leader there, Republican, Kentucky, did not get his way. Here he was, called everybody back on Sunday, saying there are unacceptable outcomes here.
That's a totally unacceptable outcome. Completely and totally unacceptable outcome. So we won't be doing that. And so we're left with option two, the House passed bill. It's certainly not ideal. But along with votes on some modest amendments that attempt to ensure the program can actually work as promised, it's now the only realistic way forward.
The unacceptable outcome, just letting the NSA program expire. But others, and from his own state, in particular Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, saying it had to go, that these were the founders would roll over in their graves and he wouldn't take it anymore.
I'm not going to take it anymore. I don't think the American people are going to take it anymore. We can't allow this. We can't allow the rule of law to be so trod upon that we live in an arbitrary governmental world where they collect anything they want, anytime they want. We are not collecting the information of spies. We are not collecting the information of terrorists. We are collecting all American citizens' records all of the time.
In the end, it's the USA Freedom Act that is now the law of the land. The Patriot Act, with its provisions that were interpreted to allow the NSA to go in and scoop up all those phone records, that will not stand. Nancy Cordes, do some interpretation for us here. Was Mitch McConnell really so devoted in security terms to that NSA capacity, or was this some kind of Kentucky throwdown, Hatfield and McCoys, McConnell and Rand Paul duking it out? What was going on in this very bitter standoff?
This was a very genuine difference of opinion from two men who normally try to bury some of their differences to show unity on the surface because it helps out both of them. But in this case, McConnell is a member of the old guard, you know, defense hawks in the Republican Party who feel that this program is vital, that it's not broken, so why fix it? And that the information that the NSA gathers doesn't disturb anyone's privacy because these are not conversations that are being recorded. These are not people's names that are being kept. It's just a bunch of phone numbers so that investigators can make connections between suspected terrorists and the people that they're calling in the United States. So he saw no reason to change the Patriot Act. Then you've got Rand Paul, sort of a new generation, arguing, you know, this is beyond the scope of the NSA, and hey, if they're doing this and we didn't know about it until Edward Snowden revealed it in 2013, who knows what else they're collecting? And that is what really angered McConnell and a few of his colleagues, and you could see McConnell almost shaking with anger on the Senate floor during that clip that you played, because they felt that Rand Paul was being disingenuous and sort of implying that the NSA is collecting all kinds of information that they don't believe that it is. So they felt that he was unfairly setting the terms of the debate. But in the end, far more members of Congress from both sides agreed with him that there's no proof that this NSA program has stopped any terrorist acts, at least none that the administration can point to, and that this information should be held by the phone companies instead.
Jack Beatty, in the end, we come up with the USA Freedom Act. The phone companies will hold it. The government, NSA, will have to go to them with court orders to get particular information. Many in House and Senate saying, look, this will still work. We still have what we need, but it's not as intrusive. It's not the federal government owning all this. Wall Street Journal editorial page is conservative, of course, but it's interesting that they say this is a sham, that it's not going to really work here. They say the House bill, which ultimately became the law, offers the illusion of a functional metadata program, not the genuine article, that congressmen are not really owning what they're up to, that they're really shutting this down, and the U.S. is more vulnerable here. Now, do you think people are trying to have it both ways, Jack? We're going to end this, but we've still got everything we need. Is that true?
I'm not in the position to assess it, but what I'm struck with and is today's New York Times, another revelation from Edward Snowden that the government is now trying to look into hacking through the NSA. Foreign hacking. Well, that's certainly relevant to what we see in the headlines. But you know, this act, this USA Freedom Act, it really could, with justice, be called the Edward J. Snowden Act. I mean, he really is. He is the source of this reform. If that is espionage, then I don't know what I don't know what treason is.
Well, he's still sitting in exile in Russia, so he has some idea what the impact of that framing of it is. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. The big new hack attack curbs on domestic NSA surveillance. Another homegrown terror suspect shot. Got more hats in the ring, Caitlyn Jenner. Of course, the sad death and observance remembrance of Beau Biden this week. With us, Lisa Lehrer, national political reporter for the Associated Press, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, who is in Delaware as we speak in Wilmington. Jack Beatty's here. Nancy Cordes, in Wilmington, Delaware, we don't want to lose sight of the fact, the reason that you are there, of course, Beau Biden, Vice President Joe Biden's son, dying last weekend. Today is the funeral. Here's a little sound from one woman standing in line for memorial service talking with ABC News about Beau Biden and his family.
And he was so young, and they've lived through such travails. I can't believe it, but pure respect for them.
A viewing today of Beau Biden's body, funeral tomorrow. Nancy Cordes, what are you finding the mood there to be in Delaware around this sad early death?
Well, it's unbelievable. People in Delaware really do think of the Biden family as Delaware's family, and they're especially connected to this family, not because it's, you know, a big prominent political family, both in the nation and here in Delaware, which it is, but also because of the tragedy that befell Vice President Joe Biden just six weeks after he was elected to the Senate, when his wife and his infant daughter were killed in a car crash. And so this is the second child that he is losing too soon. Beau Biden was 46, and Beau Biden was beloved here in Delaware in his own right. He was the state attorney general for years. He was a member of the Delaware Army National Guard. He was quick to give a hug, just like his father. And what was really remarkable is that his casket he was laid in honor in the state Senate chamber yesterday, and I'd say about 1,000 people lined up to pay their respects. And Vice President Biden stood closest to the casket, and he greeted every single one of those people. Wow. The line stretched down the block and around the corner, and it took something like 2.5 hours for everyone to walk through, and you would think that each person was the first person in line because Vice President Biden, his wife Jill, Beau's wife Hallie, hugged each one of them and, you know, really connected with each one of them. It was a really touching but clearly very, very sad day where you really saw a range of emotions on the Vice President's face, from joy at seeing a lot of people that he loves and people who loved his son, but also pain and tears at some points because he's called his son Beau the finest person he's ever known, and he's very clearly close to his family and his children in particular.
Check, BD, that's so Joe Biden, touching every one of that thousand, whatever the number is, and taking another loss here, family loss.
You know, and when we think of him, we think of a man with a smile. His temperament is a triumph over his experience, and one can only hope, pray, that that will happen with this tragedy as well.
One has to hope exactly that. We have people calling in on the NSA. Can I get Eugene in Waterloo, Iowa, here? We've got more to look at. We've got a lot to look at on the political front, but before we move away from this, Eugene in Waterloo, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I've just got a point to make that I don't believe that's going to change anything. They're still going to collect the information.
How will they do it? If the phone companies have it, they've got to go through the court. The phone companies, they're not all saying, we're going to just give you anything and everything anytime here. They weren't too happy about all this in the first place.
You think the phone companies were not happy about it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, certainly Silicon Valley wasn't happy, and I think phone companies too. The idea that, you know, it puts them in a bind and maybe even legal vulnerability when they're channeling all this stuff under vague legislation to the federal government. But you think it's going to go right on?
Well, I don't trust AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South. That's my point, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. You may be. I don't. The weird thing is, Eugene, I appreciate your call. Lisa Lair, the weird thing is that now we've got this big debate, this showdown, throwdown on Capitol Hill, and here we are a week after, nearly, and still a sense that do we really know what's going to happen or not? That is the strange thing about the time we live in, Lisa.
Well, certainly politically, it's a fascinating question. You know, there is the question is whether Rand Paul's moment has passed, right? He was really the only individual in this very, very, very large and emerging Republican field to come out very, very strongly against this program. So the question is whether the ground has shifted under him. I mean, clearly, Eugene has a lot of concerns about the NSA collection of bulk data. I think there are a lot of voters out there, particularly on the Republican side, who share those concerns. But there's also a sense of anxiety on national security issues, particularly with the rise of ISIS and these images that are coming back of beheadings, of, you know, even of American captives. So there's this debate in the Republican Party over whether national security outweighs these kinds of protections of personal data. And it's a debate that's going to play out in full force in the coming months as we go through this Republican primary process.
Of course, we had the incident in Boston, more than an incident. A young man lost his life. Police say they were following him. Police and FBI say they were following him because he was expressing sympathies with Islamic radicalism, that when they confront that he was planning to kill somebody, maybe a Boston police officer, when they confronted him at a drugstore, he had a knife. They say he came at them. And soon everybody's talking about homegrown terror again. Here was Texas Republican Representative Michael McCaul testifying Wednesday at a congressional hearing on social media and terrorism, connecting Osama Rahim in Boston to online ISIS propaganda. This is chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee.
Mr. Rahim was killed by federal law enforcement officers after lunging at them with a knife. Was being investigated by the Boston Joint Terrorism Task Force after communicating with and spreading ISIS propaganda online. Known associates of Mr. Rahim are also being arrested as we speak. These cases are a reminder of the dangers posed by individuals radicalized through social media.
Jack Beatty,
with that sort of new picture of what's going on in this country, the FBI is saying they're tracking, I think they said, at least 100 people in this way. I mean, Raheem was being tracked 24 hours a day. It gives you a sense of a whole lot of people out there that law enforcement sees as kind of on the bubble, on the edge. I mean, this guy of doing something, they say, allegedly here, it makes the homegrown threat seem more real and present than I had quite imagined, Jack.
Yes. At the same time, I'm reading in the Times today that it's about 20 people a year who've been arrested on charges of, planning or committing crimes in the U.S. motivated by radical Islam ideals. That's since 2001, 20 yep. people a year. Well, is that a tolerable, or, you know, can society live with, what if that becomes 100 or 200, or who knows? Because the future, that's the future. ISIS isn't going away. Quote, radical Islamists aren't going away. And we're going to have to find a way to live with this. Now, that 24-hour monitoring, that's just inches away, it seems to me, from sort of preventive detention. You're not being detained, but they're watching you really closely. And you can easily imagine pressures mounting in that direction if more of this kind of thing goes on. You know, I remember the very first show we did after 9/11, Tom, Stanley Hoffman, the great Harvard historian, said he wasn't worried about the damage that Osama bin Laden would do to us. He was worried about the damage we might do to ourselves in fighting him.
I mean, the thing is, Jack, on the other hand, from social media, the law enforcement was saying that he was looking at maybe going after, maybe trying to kill Pam Geller, the woman who's held these, you know, we'll draw Muhammad images if we want to, the contest in Texas. That looked too complicated, so he talked about going after a Boston police officer, we are told. I mean, if that was you on that, some kind of hit list, Jack, you might be happy for that surveillance.
Oh, indeed, indeed, indeed. But you know, here we're talking about the excesses of the security state, and now we need the security state. All I'm saying is pressures in this direction toward more and more surveillance, toward perhaps even preventive. These pressures are going to grow.
The other side of this, which is interesting, Lisa, Nancy, Osama Raheem, African American, his aunt spoke out just yesterday. Not convinced of the story being told by the police, and making this connection of what we've seen in Ferguson and Baltimore, the assertion of young blacks, men in particular, feeling threatened by law enforcement, saying it's not fair to tie that to terrorism and Islam. Here was Osama Rahim's Aunt Karen.
I think he felt threatened. And as you all know, with the current slaughter of black men going on right now across the nation, that's enough to make any and all black men feel threatened. When you add the factor of Islam, now everyone in the media wants to add terrorism to it. If it wasn't for him being Muslim, then we would not be hearing terrorism.
She doesn't want that added, Lisa, and we hear it right there. She lost a nephew. But you can imagine if McCall's picture that he paints is true, ISIS might look at this and say, hey, that's a great connection to make, that African-American unrest and our goals.
Oh, yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, what's so concerning about the whole rise of ISIS for folks in the security world and law enforcement, you know, they've called it a new phase of terrorism, is that so much of it's happening beyond the eyes of U.S. intelligence, right? It's happening on what some of those folks call the dark web. It's all recruiting online and on Twitter, on Facebook, and then taking it to systems, online systems that intelligence may not be able to see. So it's really hard for them to track all these people and even track the arguments that ISIS is making, you know, in these private areas, dark areas of the internet. And that makes it even harder to prevent these attacks and, you know, sort of figure out who sees these tweets and these videos and decides to launch these lone wolf attacks, and how influenced they are by, you know, this kind of radical thinking, and how influenced they are by maybe mental illness or other things like that. It's very difficult for law enforcement to figure out who to track and who not.
Nancy Cordes, do you feel any unease in Congress? On the one hand, they're pushing the NSA out of some of its capacity here. On the other, they're watching all this. They don't want to end up, you know, with some kind of attack and holding the bag of responsibility.
Yes, although interestingly, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Richard Burr, told me that terrorists are moving away from cell phone communication anyway. They're moving to the dark web, as Lisa pointed out. They're moving to things like texting and Snapchat, things that can't be tracked as easily, where you can't take a number and store it. And I think that that's a key to why a lot of defense hawks didn't fight more vigorously against moving this program out of the NSA. That's why you didn't see the president himself fighting vigorously. He kind of gave into this about a year ago because they saw the writing on the wall. They saw that terrorists are starting to communicate in different ways, and that perhaps capturing everyone's phone records isn't the most effective way to go after them anyway.
Of course, the threat of radical Islam right in the middle of Lindsey Graham's announcement for the presidency, and we had a lot of announcements in the last week. Here's a little bit from him. Lindsey Graham, South Carolina Republican senator, of course, on Monday announcing his bid, warning of a growing threat from radical Islam.
Radical Islam is running wild. They have more safe havens, more money, more capability, and more weapons to strike our homeland than any time since 9/11. They are large, they are rich, they're entrenched. As president, I will make them small, poor, and on the run.
Lindsey Graham in South Carolina there. Lisa Lara, we have a crowded house now of Republican contenders for the nomination for the presidency. More Democrats in the ring as well. Look at Lindsey Graham in this burgeoning field, Lisa. What do you see?
Right. This Republican field is like Ocean's 11, but sadly without Brad Pitt and George Clooney.
Okay. Sorry, ladies.
Some kind of, by my count, there are 10 candidates, Republican candidates who are in. And if you count Jeb Bush, who's getting in about a week, that's 11. We know of five more. So we're looking at a total of 16 candidates just on the Republican side. It's a wide open race that's really exciting for reporters and voters. It's not exactly what the party wanted. They think this can get really messy. It's a combination of the calendar being delayed, various candidates waiting for the state that they think they could do the best in to come up, and also the changes in the campaign finance system. If you get a freelance billionaire, there's all these, you know, rich guys and gals out there who are happy to back a candidate, and that allows someone who may not be all that viable in terms of their polling number to stay in the race for a really long time. So the Republican field is that, you know, a candidate, their eventual nominee, will have to go through this process, and in the course of it could get too damaged to win in a general. That whoever is victorious towards the nominee to get there will have to take positions that would hurt them with independent voters to win over the Republican base. That's certainly something we saw with Romney in 2012, particularly with the position he had to strike on immigration. And that's certainly a concern for Republican leaders this time around.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in the Lindsey Graham candidacy? We'll look at more than that, but what about Senator Graham?
Well, you know, Tom, in Britain, Fleet Street journos would identify Senator Graham as a pocky politician, one possessing a sly sense of humor. You could see it this week at a New Hampshire House party. He was speaking in the game room, and he greeted the two horned creatures on the wall behind him with, "Bill, Hillary, how you all doing?" You know, he's a witty hawk. He's really a witty hawk. He's for boots on the ground to fight ISIS in Iraq. He's for bombing more or less everyone that deserves it. In January, he was one of only five GOP senators to vote for a resolution that affirmed that global warming is, in fact, human-caused. In 2010, he was one of 14 Republicans to vote for immigration reform, including a path for citizenship. Does he have a chance to win in this primary? You know, it's getting so crowded that carrying your niche might be enough. For Graham, That niche would be hawks who are reform-minded on domestic matters and who relish hawky wit.
Good-humored hawks for Graham. I don't know if that's a bumper sticker, but it is getting crowded out there, Nancy. Anybody going to be left on Capitol Hill? Are they all going to be on the hustings?
You know, it's really funny because, well, it's funny for us who are watching it. It's not so funny for leaders like Mitch McConnell who are trying to keep everyone in line, and yet you've got all these senators who are now running for president all looking to set themselves apart. So they're taking defiant stands against the leadership, which makes things challenging. And they're also taking a beating from people like Governor Perry, who got into the race this week, who argued, hey, I don't just stand around giving speeches like members of Congress. I actually did things as an administrator, as a governor of Texas.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Caitlyn Jenner, formerly Bruce, on the cover of Vanity Fair in full transgender form. In a behind-the-scenes video of the photo shoot, Caitlyn said what living now as a woman means.
Caitlyn doesn't have any secrets. Soon as the Vanity Fair cover comes out, I'm free.
Free and right there for everybody to see in quite the wardrobe. President Obama awarded two Medals of Honor to World War I heroes, one black, the other Jewish, who were denied the nation's highest recognition in their lifetimes.
They both risked their own lives to save the lives of others. They both left us decades ago before we could give them the full recognition that they deserved. But it's never too late to say thank you.
No, it is not. And those were touching awards right there and long, long overdue. And Miss Piggy, the Muppet, honored at the Elizabeth A. Sackler Center for Feminist Art at the Brooklyn Museum. She sang Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive in 1982.
Oh, no, not I.
Early feminist, Miss Piggy. You can join us. We're looking at a week's news. Lisa Lehrer is with us, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Nancy Cordes is here, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Jack Beatty is with us as well. Rick in Newton, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, so it kind of seems like the new time is the old time. So if you take the Republican field now, I think it's 10 or 11 have thrown their hats in the ring. If we push forward in a few months, maybe, I don't know, 16, say by the end of the year, then when the primaries start, how do you come up with a candidate? And one of the things I'm trying to get my head around is, are we going to have a brokered Republican convention? We've got so many candidates. Is one really going to be a clear winner? And if it is a brokered convention, this is last time it happened was, I think it was Hoover. How is it decided? Is it one of these backroom things, or how does it get done? I'd be very curious to see what you all think about that.
Rick, that's a great question. Lisa Lehrer, pick it up. I mean, the old smoke-filled room was the way it was done back in the day. Then that didn't work anymore. Now, with such a crowded field, could it come to that? And if it does, who decides now when the party, the GOP, has been in many ways disempowered by the billionaires? Is it a billionaire's ball back there in the smoky room, or does the party come up and do it?
Well, certainly, billionaires who can give money to super PACs, unlimited amounts of money, have more influence than ever before. We saw that in 12 with Newt Gingrich, who was kept in the race for a really long time by the largesse of Sheldon Adelson. But there's a lot of questions about the role the party is playing in this race with so many candidates. The big question here is who gets into the debates. They're saying only 10 candidates will make it into the debate, and the cutoff is going to be determined by polling numbers, but by national polling numbers. So is it smarter if you're a candidate to spend more time on Fox News than on the ground in Iowa, if your national polling number is what's going to influence your ability to get on the debate stage, which is, can give you as a candidate one of these vital moments that can boost you up and give you fresh momentum. So that's a really interesting dynamic and a place where the party is playing a big role. Certain people in the Republican Party argued for those that cutoff to be determined not only by national polls but also, you know, statewide polls and early voting states. So it's a complicated road for the Republican Party, and their goal is to try to get to a victor as quickly as possible and avoid that brokered convention, as delicious as it would be for reporters like all of us.
But is it a possibility? I mean, you've got Jeb Bush saying this week he's going to formally declare, what, June 15th in Miami. He's taken a lot of heat for, by any definition, skirting the law here when it's clear he's going to run, but he won't declare so he can scoop up all this money. And Hillary Clinton's getting grief for the Clinton Foundation. Here's Jeb out there scooping it. It doesn't have to be declared. Does he pull up the Brinks truck, dump all that cash out now, tens of millions already raised, and become the front runner? Could it end up, Lisa, a brokered convention?
I mean, it's certainly possible. Folks in the Republican Party think it's not all that likely that someone will emerge from all this. The debates will obviously be key moments, but I wouldn't rule it out.
Nancy, I hear you there.
Well, the interesting thing is that, you know, unlike in years past, you have a number of second-tier candidates who won't necessarily drop out of the race even when they see that they don't have the numbers to win, because they're going into the race knowing that they probably can't win. They're in there for a variety of reasons, either to push a particular message or because they're from a particular wing of the party that they think isn't being represented. And so you could end up with a situation where they're still drawing votes. They're still drawing, electoral college numbers, even though mathematically there's no chance for them to win, and that hurts whoever the one or two or three front runners are who are trying to get past that magic number to clinch the nomination.
Second tier, here's one of those. Just yesterday, former Texas Governor Rick Perry announcing his candidacy, partly running on his experience of years as Texas governor.
I have dealt with crisis after crisis, from the disintegration of the space shuttle to hurricanes Katrina, Rita, Ike, to the crisis at the border and the first diagnosis of Ebola in America.
Okay, President Lisa, what's this about? Is this a rehabilitation run after his failed performance in the debates 4 years ago? Is he trying to, I don't know, why Rick Perry now?
Well, it certainly does feel like he's trying to sort of reinvent himself after that brutal oops moment. It's going to be a long, hard road. He not only because of that oops moment in the debate last time that went viral, but it's just a really crowded field. He, he's a governor of a state that's had a big economic boom, but that may not take him as far as it would have in a different, less busy field. And then he has this court case. There's a felony indictment on abuse of power and coercion charges that's in the works in Texas state court that he may be called into court to deal with in the middle of all this. So that could be difficult. But I wouldn't discount him entirely. He does have skills. He's a very strong retail politician. And as I, just jumping back to something Nancy said, the thing with this race that's so fascinating is these Republican candidates can really win by losing. Even if you come out of this process, not the nominee or losing pretty badly, we've seen in the past, these politicians can end up with a book deal or a TV contract. So there are some personal benefits for running, certainly even if you don't have much of a chance of becoming the nominee.
Makes me a little bit ill if we're all getting excited about that. Cowboy boots off, geek smart glasses on. I don't know if that's a whole new Rick Perry or not. Pat in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. Pat, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I would echo a lot of the thoughts you all have already put forward with the Republicans' thoughts on the mass of candidates. I'd also float the idea that they've lost two times for the White House run. They're not going to lose it again. And the idea is let's put as many candidates up there and be able to, I think Hillary's a front runner for the Democrats, take as many punches as they possibly can at her and amass a huge war chest. Like you mentioned about Mr. Bush, he's bringing a lot of money to the table. That's my thoughts on the whole thing.
Yeah, just too juicy a possibility for people to stay out of the race. Pat, we've got it. Thank you. Let me get one more. Chris in Nashville. Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
The reason I was calling was because the we used to have debates because people didn't know who the candidates were. We didn't know what their stance on things were. But now, you know, we can read everything about them. They can tweet all their opinions. We see them on Fox News, CNN every day. So really, like, I guess my question is, how important are the debates now? Like, we are able to see their opinion about everything. So why even have debates at this point?
Hey, Jack, ditch the debates. It's the social media era. They can tweet all day long for 27 months or whatever it is. Who needs them?
Well, you know, of Rick Perry, I mean, one is tempted to say never speak ill of the irrelevant, but you know, he could
not
he
to
could
say
tell,
Lincoln Chafee, Jack.
No, I was about to say Lincoln Chafee, but Perry could answer Chris. Why are the debates important? They upended his candidacy. That oops moment killed him. He was, we all remember the glow. Here he comes. It's going to be Texas.
Yep.
Nope. He ran right into that wall. He put the wall up. It was in a debate, and boy, they are crucial.
That third point, just couldn't bring it to mind, and it hurt. Andrea in Stoughton, Massachusetts. Andrea, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I heard Hillary for the first time speaking yesterday, and I just really, I'm going to be voting for her. She spoke about something that was really very relevant to me, stopping the Republicans from preventing people from voting. And I think that Hillary just has to remind the American people of what the Republicans have done in the last 3 years.
And
what they've done, starting with the Iraqi war.
Andrew, we've got it. And she's got your vote right there. Yes, she's talking about access to the ballot box. We've got a little of that tape that you mentioned, Andrea, yesterday. This was at Texas Southern University in Houston, Texas. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton talking to students about voting rights restrictions.
What is happening is a sweeping effort to disempower and disenfranchise people of color, poor people, and young people from one end of our country to the other.
Lisa Lehrer, Hillary's sort of low-profile strategy has meant that when she does speak, people pay attention. And this week, her big point was access to the ballot box and aiming that at the GOP, which she blames is trying to clamp down on it.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure anything Hillary Clinton ever does can be low profile, given her position as this political celebrity. But yeah, part of what the strategy there is by the Hillary campaign is to keep together the Obama coalition. Obama built this winning coalition of minority voters and young voters and women. Hillary Clinton is trying to motivate that same group of people. And so we've seen her tacking to the left on a number of issues, voting rights, of course, this week, which is particularly an issue that particularly resonates with minority voters. We saw the same thing with immigration. We saw it with women's issues, with things like equal pay or family leave, things that maybe appeal more to women, even though they really should appeal to everyone with a child, I think. So she's trying really hard to keep that group together and to try to win a general election. And she also benefits from the fact that she's pretty unlikely to face a competitive primary unless something pretty surprising happens.
Nancy Cordes, what's your sense? One of our callers saying, look, it's about the Republicans. It's likely their turn here after a few losses. How does it feel in Washington? Do people have a presumption going on at this point, or does it still really feel between the parties like wide open race?
I think that they still believe, based just purely on Democrats, that it's the Democrats' race to lose. Not that they couldn't lose it if Republicans do very well, but that Democrats start out with an advantage simply because this is a presidential election year, and when that happens, there are more young people voting, there are more minorities voting, and that tends to benefit Democrats. So if, as Lisa said, Hillary Clinton can bring together the same coalition that President Obama did in 2008 and 2012, then she's kind of got a built-in advantage. Now, if she faces someone from a big swing state like Florida, someone like Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush, that could change things. If she faces someone with Hispanic ties who could appeal to Hispanic voters, again, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, either as a presidential candidate or vice presidential candidate, that could change things. There's all kinds of things that could affect that baseline demographic reality.
Claire in Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Yes, I'd like to bring up another presumed Republican candidate, Scott Walker from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I am very upset, Tom. Last night or yesterday, our legislature passed a law limiting abortions to 20 weeks or less. And even in the case of rape or incest, I think this is just puritanical. This is a safe legal procedure.
Did Governor Walker push it, Claire? Was he behind it?
Oh, he's been very, very, very behind it. He has announced in advance he would sign it into law. And this is almost surreal in aspects.
Claire, our time is short. In a way that speaks for itself, that will be closely focused upon, no doubt, if his candidacy continues to show some strength. I want to be sure we get to one more here on the Democratic side. Yes, Lincoln Chafee coming in, former Republican, then independent, now running as a Democrat, and former Baltimore mayor and Maryland governor Martin O'Malley announcing he was running for the Democratic nomination. He attacked Hillary Clinton and her economic policies.
The CEO of Goldman Sachs let his employees know that he'd be just fine with either Bush or Clinton. I bet he would. Well, I've got news for the bullies of Wall Street. The presidency is not a crown to be passed back and forth by you between two royal families.
No thanks, says Martin O'Malley, to Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton. What do you see on the Clinton front and the O'Malley challenge, Jack?
Well, you know, O'Malley is late to the party, and he's got somebody who's speaking his lines, Bernie Sanders. I mean, and Bernie speaks with perhaps a little more conviction on this subject, being a democratic socialist. So I think the momentum has carried beyond him. You know, last week the Times was promoting, who really kind of ignored Bernie's announcement. They were pushing him. They were saying, "Look at these crowds in Iowa. This is real. He's getting momentum." Well, I know Martin O'Malley would like to see some of that too.
Yeah. So much time to go, and still, this is the time when they're jumping in the pool and the splashing is all over the place. Grateful to all of you for being with us today. Nancy Cordes there in Wilmington, Delaware, for the observance of viewing and funeral of Beau Biden. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us from Delaware this week.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you as always.
Congressional correspondent for CBS News. Lisa Lehrer, national political reporter for the Associated Press with us from Washington. Thank you so much for your time and insights, Lisa.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thank you very much to you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, continue this conversation. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.